And you can see photos of Titian's Diana masterpieces at our website, npr.org.
From Titian now to 20th century photographer Ouija. He dedicated his career to documenting the sordid side of life in New York City. Ouija's pictures inspired a generation of American photographers and filmmakers, and now they've inspired a work of literary fiction. Alan Chews has our review.
Pulitzer Prize-winning story writer Robert Olin Butler has written stories based, among other things, on old postcards and famous people who died by decapitation. The webpage of the online fiction magazine Narrative, which is at www.narrativemagazine.com, is currently showing off a short work Butler first created several years ago. He's invented captions, he calls them Ouija stories, for about 6 dozen flash photographs by the famous 20th century visual chronicler of urban life, the Austrian-born Arthur Fellig, better known as Ouija. Rich, poor, night owls, children, the living and the dead, Ouija reveals his images to us. Robert Olin Butler bids them speak in lyrical voices that stand against the dark patches and do a reality in the photographs. A night on the ladder in Harlem, says New York City fireman Abraham Johnson, and an infant in my arms, a girl with a cough that has nothing to do with the fire, and we come down through a thrash of smoke, and I canopy her face with my hand, and I swear I can feel her breath on my palm. In many of these enlightened captions, you can feel the breath of life, too.
Ouija stories by Robert Olin Butler can be found online at the website narrativemagazine.com. Alan Chews teaches writing at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. You can connect with NPR and your favorite member station, wherever you are. Get the NPR app for your mobile device. You can also lean back and enjoy NPR.org, optimized for the iPad. This is NPR.
The unrest in Libya has oil prices surging around the world. In New York, they reached a 2.5-year high today, nearly $94 a barrel. And that, in turn, sends stock prices down. The spike reflects fears that political turmoil could spread to the world's biggest oil producers. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
After the Lockerbie bombing, the United States imposed economic sanctions on Tripoli. For many years, U.S. companies were barred from doing business with Libya. Once the sanctions were lifted, companies like Marathon Petroleum and ExxonMobil rushed to take a piece of Libya's huge oil reserves. Energy analyst Fadel Gate of Oppenheimer & Company notes that they had to pay dearly to do business with the Gaddafi regime.
Gaddafi and his cronies put their money, this money in their bank accounts. And obviously, that's why the people are rioting, because they don't see anything trickling down to them.
Gates says partly as a result of the sanctions, Libya's oil industry hasn't developed as fast as it could. It produces about 1.8 million barrels of oil a day, about 2% of the world's output. And even if Libya stopped producing oil altogether, there's enough spare capacity in other countries like Saudi Arabia to make up for the loss. But the unrest in the country has sent a shiver through the oil markets. Gates says with the world economy recovering, there's a growing demand for oil right now.
In a tight market, for whatever reason, any perception of supply disruption will have an impact on price.
Gates says the sheer lack of reliable information coming out of Libya right now has made the markets especially nervous. Gaddafi's decision to declare force majeure over its oil contracts today was another worrisome sign. It allows the regime to break any contracts it signed with oil companies. David Pumphrey is an oil expert at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
It usually indicates there are deeper troubles, so I think many people are watching now to see what is the reason for this and what does it mean for Libyan exports into the marketplace.
But what's really scaring the markets, he says, is what the Libyan unrest says about the region as a whole. The first two countries to be swept up in the unrest, Tunisia and Egypt, weren't big players in the energy business, and the markets could shrug off their impact. Since then, the violence has spread to Bahrain and now Libya, he says.
We're beginning to see an accumulation of situations. Individually, none of them should be a problem. Taken together, I think it causes more concern, especially if there's a risk that some of this spreads into the really big producers in the Gulf states.
The real fear right now is that the turmoil could extend to Saudi Arabia, the region's biggest oil supplier by far. In that case, the increases in oil prices that the world has seen so far will seem small by comparison. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. In the old days, wiretapping was easy. Police just tapped the wire. Even with the advent of cell phones, all they had to do was take a warrant to the phone company and tell them to tap the number. But now, in an age of Skype and instant messaging, things are trickier. And as NPR's Martin Costi reports, law enforcement says it needs help.
Federal law already requires tech companies to cooperate with court-ordered surveillance. The problem, says FBI General Counsel Valerie Caproni, is that the companies that offer things like webmail or social networking sometimes can't cooperate.
What we're finding, and it's not universally the case across the board, but what we're seeing is they do not have intercept solutions available for all of the types of services that they're offering for people to use to communicate.
Back in 1994, Congress passed a law requiring the new cell phone networks to provide intercept solutions, as Caproni puts it. Now the Obama administration would like to see something similar for communication systems on the Internet. The FBI, the Commerce Department, and the various spy agencies have been meeting for months to discuss possible legislation, and there's been a preliminary hearing on the subject in the House of Representatives.
It was a very weird hearing.
Computer engineer Susan Landau was there to give testimony, but she says it was hard to offer analysis because the administration is being vague. For instance, the FBI won't specify which Internet systems are at issue because it says it doesn't want to advertise its blind spots.
They just haven't detailed their problems.
I mean, are you convinced there is a concrete problem?
I'm convinced that there are on occasion problems. How bad these are, it's hard to know.
Landau specialized in Internet security at Sun Microsystems. She says whatever the extent of law enforcement's problem, the cure may be worse. She wrote a book called Surveillance or Security, which argues that built-in eavesdropping systems can sometimes open computers up to non-government spying. And the danger isn't just hypothetical. She points to a case in Greece where software on the cell phone network meant for lawful eavesdropping ended up allowing somebody to spy on the prime minister and other officials.
Somebody went into the switch and wiretapped these 100 senior officials for a period of 10 months. It was discovered when a text message went awry and quickly stopped, but we still to this day don't know who did it.
She says imagine if similar back doors were built into all email services or social networks. It's an argument that resonates in Washington these days, as evidence mounts that the government and American industry have been targets of persistent and effective hacking attacks from overseas. And then there's the problem of the Internet's decentralization. It's one thing to regulate a handful of phone companies, but when it comes to all the different ways you can chat online, it's hard even to keep track of them all. And some aren't even run by companies.
My name is Jacob Applebaum, and I'm a developer of the Tor project. It helps to anonymize people and to keep them safe and private on the Internet.
Tor's encryption system has been used by everybody from the U.S. military to WikiLeaks. Applebaum's involvement with Tor earned him close government scrutiny. That's one reason he now works as a computer researcher here at the University of Washington's Computer Science Department. He hopes the job will give him a little extra legal cover. He says if the government ever told him to build an eavesdropping function into Tor, he'd refuse.
Oh, I mean, I'd leave the country. I would not be in a country that was so hostile to people having personal autonomy and liberty.
It may not come to that. Valerie Caproni of the FBI says the administration is trying to find what she calls an 80% solution, something that facilitates government access to most online communication, but not necessarily all of it. Martin Costi, NPR News.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this some more with NPR health policy correspondent Julie Rodner, who's in our studios. Julie, good morning.
Good morning.
Just to clarify what's happening here, isn't the health care law that Congress passed last year supposed to cover or at least give people an opportunity, everybody an opportunity to get covered in a situation like this?
Well, yes, and assuming it doesn't get repealed or ruled unconstitutional, it will, and it will help couples like these. But as Jenny pointed out in her story, that won't happen until the year 2014. And between now and then, there's a lot of frustration and consternation on the part of patients and, I might add, states.
What are the options for people in a situation like the Boyles? Because there must be many.
Well, yes, there is a new program that's already in effect called a high-risk pool that was established in the law, and it's supposed to give the uninsured a way to get insurance between now and then, sort of a bridge to coverage, if you will.
High-risk pool, that just means you're at high risk for disease. Insurers are not really very interested in giving you anything very affordable, and so you're thrown in this pool of people where you're supposed to be able to get insurance.
Exactly. Now, technically, this couple could get into one of these pools, which are available in every state, but there are some big catches that have kept a lot of people from signing up.
Catches?
Catches, yes. One big one is that in order to get into these pools, you have to have been uninsured for at least 6 months. That means in cases like the Boyles, where they're losing insurance at the end of the month, they'd have to wait until September before they could sign up for the program.
Okay.
Another big obstacle in these high-risk pools is price. I did a little research. In Pennsylvania, it would cost each of the Boyles $283.20 a month, or about $600 for the two of them. That's a lot less than the high-risk pools in a lot of states run on their own, but it's still a whole lot more than the $36 a month that they've been paying under the plan that's ending.
Oh, okay, so the question, if you got the $600 a month or almost $600, you can benefit, but if not, you're out of luck. So how many people are signing up for these high-risk pools under the new health care law, the national health care law?
Well, a whole lot fewer than have been expected. Nationally, as of February 10th, there were just over 10,000 people enrolled in the plans. Now, that's 50% more than there were back in November, but it's way below the estimates that were between about 200 and 375,000 people that were expected to enroll in the first year. In fact, more than a few governors declined to set up their own high-risk pool programs, and they let the federal government step in and do it. They were afraid that the program would be overrun with people and become too expensive.
All right. Well, why has it been a flop instead?
Well, if you ask federal officials, of course, they say it is not a flop. They point out it's still very new, that programs like the Children's Health Insurance Program, which now covers more than 9 million low and moderate income children, also got off to a relatively slow start. But there's other reasons that this particular program hasn't been all that popular. A couple we've already mentioned, the 6-month waiting period and that it's expensive. But there's also the problem that a lot of people who could be enrolling in this plan just don't know that it's out there. We keep talking so much about how this new coverage isn't going to start until 2014. People have no idea that some of it's already begun.
Okay, so let's get back to the Boyles, this couple that we profiled. They've got a problem. They've got a problem now. What options do they have?
Well, for actual health insurance between now and 2014, there are not that many options, unless obviously one of them finds a job that offers employee health insurance. In the meantime, they can probably get primary care from a community health center. There's more than 1,200 health centers that serve more than 20 million people every year, most of them low income or uninsured.
Just to be clear, there's a lot of states where there are cutbacks in health coverage that people have today or have had up until today. You say there are some other options, but aren't there efforts in Congress to cut back on the options?
Yes, there are. The budget bill that's moving through Congress right now would cut funding by more than $1 billion, and it might make that kind of service a lot harder to come by.
How are the problems in various states going to affect the national debate then over health care?
Well, nearly every state is struggling with budget shortfalls. Health costs are a huge part of every state's health problem. The nation's governors are coming to Washington, and they're going to be talking about what they want to do about the Medicaid program, a huge, huge budget issue, and what they're going to do about health cost. It's a really big issue. So there's a lot more to come on this subject.
Julie, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Steve.
That's NPR health policy correspondent Julie Rodner. The U.S. military views major sporting events as fertile ground for recruiting. At NASCAR races, for example, the U.S. Army even sponsors a car. Our commentator Frank DeFord has been watching the way this spending has become part of the political debate.
Even sports has gotten into the budget cutting when a House amendment was offered the other day that would prevent the Army from spending $7 million to sponsor NASCAR race car number 39. But even in a slash-and-burn atmosphere, the amendment was soundly beaten. There are a lot of congressmen prepared to do away with a lot of good old-fashioned all-American stuff. But keep your hands off my NASCAR. And let's face it, seeing that whiz-bang Chevrolet number 39 with U.S. Army splashed all over it, whipping around the Oval, chasing Jimmy Johnson, may well indeed entice some young fans to enlist. I do know this. When I watch games on TV, I see an awful lot of commercials for the Army and for the other services. You go with the fish you're biting, and sports is one logical place where the military can get its message out to the right cohort of possible young recruits. Besides, of all sports, I suspect the Army is closest to the automotive. If you like cars, there's an awful lot of what the military people always call vehicles to monkey around with in the Army. It's also true that in the United States, sports games are more associated with the military and mass displays of patriotism than our other amusements. I've always wondered why it is SOP, standard operating procedure, for the national anthem to be performed at games when no one would ever expect the Star-Spangled Banner to be played at the theater or the opera or a rock concert or at the start of the Academy Awards this Sunday. Why is this strictly an athletic devotion? And now at the start of major sporting events, it's also obligatory to have military jets flash overhead. The Olympics sends up doves. We send up fighter planes. Moreover, some baseball teams now not only play the anthem, but use God Bless America during the seventh inning stretch. The Yankees even once physically tried to stop a patron from going to the men's room when Irving Berlin's song began. Really, really. Of course, the problem is that when you make the anthem just another part of the scenery, it loses its meaning. When Pee Wee Herman had a show on Broadway a couple of months ago, he began by pretending it was grade school and having the theater rise and recite the Pledge of Allegiance. Everybody went along laughing, and I thought, that's pretty much the attitude toward our anthem at sports events now. Maybe it's not a joke, but it's just a rote imposition. It'd be better if the Star-Spangled Banner was saved for special occasions, championships. And sure, if Chevrolet No. 39 works as a recruiting commercial, let the taxpayers ante up for it. But hey, Congress, how about we cut the funding for fighter jets flying over stadiums?
Commentator Frank DeFord, the only man who could get NASCAR and Pee Wee Herman into the same sports commentary. He joins us on Wednesdays on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montagne.